Democracia e liberdade só existe quando a sua respectiva Forças Armadas assim o quer.
You know I'm totally off script right now.
Want to be nasty? Do you mind? Do you mind? We're going to have the wall. We're building the wall. We're building the wall, folks. We're building the wall.
Aaj jo partiya yahan shor macha rahi hai.
Através do voto, você não vai mudar nada nesse país, tá? Nada, absolutamente nada.
And the reality now is that we are the party of the people.
Hello there, and welcome to PALcast, a podcast by the Project on Autocratic Legalism, or PAL. I'm Fabio de Saia Silva at the University of Oklahoma. PAL is an effort to understand how law can be used to further, as well as to resist, autocratic forces that have been on the rise around the globe. You can learn more about the project at autocratic-legalism.net. PALcast is sponsored by the OU Center for Brazil Studies. Research and sound production for this episode were provided by Ahmed Abdelaziz. My guest today is Richard Abel, or Rick, as I and everyone else in the Law and Society community call him. Rick is an emeritus professor at UCLA Law School and has a long career in law and society studies. He served as the president of the Law and Society Association, as the editor of the Law and Society Review, and he participated in the founding conference of the Critical Legal Studies Movement in 1977. He wrote or edited countless books and articles on law and society, the legal profession, and the use of law in the pursuit of social change, including his monograph entitled Politics by Other Means, Law in the Struggle Against Apartheid, which is prefaced by Nelson Mandela. Rick is also a pioneer in global social legal studies with comparative research that led to several volumes on lawyers. Rick recently published two books on the United States War on Terror, which we at the PAL Project have found particularly useful. And that is because in these books, he shows how a liberal legal order can quickly be turned into an illiberal one to fight those who are framed as enemies of the nation. In my conversation with Rick, we discussed what these processes involve, and what they tell us about the ability that law and lawyers have, or lack, to protect or to undermine political liberalism. And in recognizing the contingency in the link between these things, we debated where we should then place our hope in. Here's the interview. Rick Abel, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
I wanted to start this conversation by sharing with you my particular reading of your scholarship, and how I see it's being helpful to a project like PAL. As you know, the literature on autocratic legalism was originally produced by scholars in constitutional law and political science, and they focus on legal change that is promoted by chief executives to consolidate power against other government branches and the civil society. And we owe a lot to this literature. It is very insightful. But the story that it tells tends to take the following course. Democracy and political liberalism are there. They are secured by constitutions and courts. And then a leader with autocratic dispositions comes in, elected by the people. And this leader starts using and abusing legislation and the courts to remove law's liberal content, which eventually leaves us with a legal facade behind which rests autocratic power. When I read your work, I see a slightly different story, a story where democracy, constitutions, political liberalism, courts, all these things not only coexist with, but even house systematic denial of basic rights to some people, the victims of the war on terror that you studied. Is this how you see the relationship between democracy, political liberalism, and law as more contingent and fragile than we would like it to be and usually tend to assume it is?
So, Fabio, yes, I think that your reading is correct. I will reframe it slightly, but the basic thrust of it is absolutely right. I would reframe it in the following way. All liberal democracies are built on fundamental flaws. Each of them is a sinner, if you want to use religious terminology. Let me list some of the basic flaws in American democracy beginning in 1776. They won't be unfamiliar to your listeners, but I think they're worth repeating because they are at the very core of the American polity. The treatment of Native Americans, the rape and theft of the country from the people who originally inhabited it. The treatment of African Americans as enslaved peoples and as people who were disenfranchised. The treatment of other minorities, Chinese Americans who built the railroads but were excluded, Latinos who have been migrating to North for centuries but have suffered all sorts of discriminations, Japanese Americans during World War II and the internment, the working class and the ways in which unions were precluded from organizing. More recently, gays and lesbians and transgender people. So these flaws have been part of American democracy for over 200 years. Periodically, we recognize some of these problems and begin to try to ameliorate them and to redress and to pay reparations. But the basic flaws are there, and they will be something that liberal democracy will have to continue to struggle with. So, on the one hand, I don't think that there's anything novel about what has been happening now. At the same time, I think it is appropriate to speak about crisis, even if we recognize that crisis is something that recurs periodically. So the crisis that induced me to write about the war on terror was, of course, the attack on the World Trade Centers and the Pentagon on September 11th, 2001. I'll just give you a little bit of personal history there, if that's okay. I was teaching at NYU at the time. So I was sitting in my office at 9 o'clock that morning, less than a mile away from ground zero. And I think my wife called me and said I should turn on the radio, which I could do on my computer, to see what was happening. I did. I would continue to prepare to teach torts, which is what I have been paid for the last 40 years. I then went to the classroom at 10 o'clock, and of course there was nobody there. I stayed in my office all day trying to pretend that nothing was happening, and then had to walk home because the subways weren't operating from Greenwich Village up to the Upper West Side. And I realized that this was a pivotal moment. Not only was it a pivotal moment in a way that resembled and in some ways even exceeded Pearl Harbor, which happened a couple of months after I was born, so I don't remember it, but I've had that story told to me many times by my parents. But this was the first attack ever on the continental United States. So it really did transform society. And it set in train a set of legal innovations, which is what I tried to track in the War on Terror books.
Can you talk more about these changes?
Okay, that happened in a variety of ways. One, it was perfectly clear that the Bush administration decided that they would use this as an opportunity to enact a series of laws that they had wanted to enact for a long time that were so-called law and order legislation. So the USA Patriot Act was passed almost unanimously. There were almost no opponents to it because of the moment in which it occurred. And it curbed civil liberties and civil rights in all sorts of ways, which we are still dealing with. So they were able to use the emergency as a cover to make all sorts of other changes. I would just add that much the same has been happening during the current pandemic in the United States and in other countries as well. And it's something that we have to be very concerned about. Second, they did enact specific provisions that have caused problems that are still unsolved. So they adopted a new structure, the military commissions, to try the people whom they had interned in Guantanamo. Those military commissions have now been in place for almost 20 years, and there has not been a single trial completed under them. It's really the most extraordinary example of how not to innovate in the legal system, because it was done in such a hasty and undeliberate fashion that it introduced all sorts of constitutional violations, which are still being challenged by a very vigorous team of defense lawyers representing the five accused of the 9/11 attacks and others accused under the attacks in Indonesia and on the USS Cole. And these trials are not moving forward. Nothing is happening. No jury has been impaneled. They are years away from the trial stage and probably decades away from the appellate stage, which means almost certainly that the accused are going to die in Guantanamo before ever being convicted of anything.
And how, in these changes, does law get to cement exceptions to its own rule?
And so I write in the books that the Bush administration sought, I think, with considerable rhetorical success, to justify the use of torture. And now everybody agrees that the so-called enhanced interrogation techniques, the EITs, were in fact torture. They justified the use of torture by invoking purposive or substantively rational thinking. That is, they use the ticking bomb scenario. They used utilitarian reasoning to say that given the number of people who might be damaged in the case of a ticking bomb, even torturing a single person was justified on a standard measure of costs and benefits. That was the argument they made. And I challenged that argument on the ground that they offered absolutely no evidence for any of the points they made. They had to make the proposition that torture was A, necessary, that is, no other mechanism would have succeeded, that it was sufficient, that is, it actually elicited information, that the information it elicited was true, and that the true information that it elicited was necessary to prevent this terrible event. There was no evidence for any of those propositions, and on many of them, no evidence would be available. I spent my 40 plus years teaching in American law schools, teaching torts, a standard first year course. And each of the tort rules is justified by that kind of utilitarian reasoning. We need to impose sanctions on people in order to make them change their behavior. Or alternatively, we must not impose sanctions because it would result in untoward consequences. The best example of that is the partial immunity that police officials and other governmental officials have for their actions. No evidence is ever offered for those propositions. In most cases, no evidence would be available. And yet that kind of utilitarian reasoning is absolutely hegemonic. We use it in our daily lives. We make all sorts of cost-benefit calculations every day. We can't imagine operating differently. What troubles me is the scientific, or I should probably say scientistic, because it's really an abuse of science, rhetoric that undergirds the exercise of power when the exercise of power cannot really be legitimated on those terms.
This is something I find especially provocative in your work, the attention that you give to the use of symbols and discourse, both in the construction of exception and in resistance against it. Besides this use of utilitarian philosophy by those pushing for the war on terror, you also mentioned that the victims of the war, or their advocates, tried to use images of the abuses that they were being inflicted with to maybe shift the terms of the conversation about the lawfulness or lawlessness of their treatment, like when they released photos from Abu Ghraib.
Eventually, these victims even tried to turn their own bodies into means of resistance, like when they self-mutilated or went on hunger strikes with the same purpose. And on one hand, I think that you're making a compelling case here for the need of an interpretive analysis of law, democracy, and democratic backsliding, that we take seriously the cultural character of law and that we begin to look at how shared ideologies get to shape and reshape liberal legality and eventually turn liberal legality into illiberal legality. But on the other hand, given that cultural wars are so central to the business of modern autocrats, oftentimes powered by technology and social media, it feels very scary to realize that law and culture are mutually constitutive. What future do you see for the rule of law in a society that grows so fragmented in terms of its cultural fabric?
Let me start first by talking about the role of cultural symbols, which I think is extraordinarily powerful. So I'll give an example that I just encountered recently. I don't know whether you or your listeners have seen the film, The Trial of the Chicago Seven, but everybody should see the film, even though it's not a documentary, it's a reconstruction, because it's incredibly powerful. And much of it is taken from the actual transcript of the trial and the words of Judge Hoffman, who presided, and of the defendants and of their lawyers. The dramatization, the visual and audio presentation of these ideas can be enormously powerful. Let me go back to some of the examples that are part of my visual consciousness and may also resonate with some of your listeners, and then come to the more recent ones just to show that this is always an issue. So there is an image that every member of my generation knows, which is of a naked Vietnamese girl running down a road, her clothes having been burned off by napalm, having been dropped by American military. It's a searing image that nobody can forget. Or the image of a young woman kneeling by the body of somebody at Kent State University who has just been shot by the National Guard during the demonstrations against the war. Or the African-American children who are trying to attend newly integrated schools in the South and are being spat at by parents and by their fellow students, or by the dogs that the police set on protesters in the South. So all of those images are, I can sum them up. I can actually see them in my mind, even though I haven't seen those photographs for decades. The same is true today. And the most striking, there are two striking examples. There are many others I could come up with. One, of course, is George Floyd and the impact of the video of his killing by the police officer, which has been shown over and over and over again, and which everybody, especially African-Americans, but everybody in the United States now has in their mind. We'll see what impact that actually has on the jury in the next few days. Or the image of young children separated from their parents at the border, children, infants crying for their mothers, ripped apart in scenes that really haven't been seen since the Holocaust, when you saw the Nazis in Germany do the same thing for Jewish families. So those images are extraordinarily powerful, and they are the images that shape consciousness. You mentioned social media, and social media, in this instance, I'm thinking of both as a visual through YouTube and videos, but primarily as language through chat rooms of and various kinds. We know it's incredibly powerful. We know, and it seems utterly uncontrolled. I've actually been taking notes about this recently because I find the problem insoluble. I don't see how we are going to, it's Pandora's box. I don't see how we're going to put those words back in the box and prevent them from reaching the ears of people without engaging in state censorship of a kind that we don't want, and that in any case is probably unconstitutional under the First Amendment. finally, about the fragmentation of society. Yes, society is fragmented. I'm not sure it's more fragmented now than it has been at any time in the past. The level of the rhetoric, the nature of the language that gets used changes over time. Sometimes it's more moderate, sometimes it's more unconstrained. But I think the divisions, as I said earlier, are there in the fundamental framework of society. Another way of thinking about it is that the rule of law is something we want for ourselves, but not for others. When I was editing the Law and Society Review, which is now many decades ago, I published an early article by Austin Surratt. He wouldn't disclaim it, but it's a very early Austin Surratt. It's not the Austin who engages primarily in interpretive sociology today. And it was survey research that demonstrated that Americans believe that the constitutional rights are essential for their speech and their expressive activity, but not for that of others. And I think that's unfortunately generally true, that we want rights for ourselves, we don't want rights for others. The lines of those divisions have changed, but that kind of selfishness as opposed to selflessness is, I'm afraid, a constant.
Let me change topics here and touch upon something that is also central to your career. I think most of our listeners, when they hear your name, what comes to their minds is your series of books, Lawyers in Society, which was probably one of the first attempts to compare the legal profession across countries, and which has been updated with Lawyers in 21st Century Societies. As you know, there's an important literature in the field of law and society about the role of lawyers in promoting political liberalism. And there is also a large subset of the development industry that was based on the premise that more lawyers and better lawyers equals more freedoms. But there seems to be enough evidence at this point that lawyers can not only fail in the promotion of political liberalism, but they can also become instruments in the construction of political illiberalism. There is no way to untangle the war on terror from the torture memos that North American lawyers wrote and from the failures of North American courts to protect the victims, which you so well document. There is no way to account for the threats to the rule of law posed by the Trump presidency without thinking of lawyers like Rudy Giuliani and Bill Barr. And when I think of Brazil, there is no way to explain the rise of Jair Bolsonaro without considering how anti-corruption laws were weaponized against the Brazilian left and the political establishment in general. Why did lawyers become so disappointing when it comes to protecting democracy and the rule of law?
The very first book that Terry Halliday and Lucien Calpic published, I reviewed, and although I knew Terry and was a friend of his, I didn't know Lucien. I wrote a very harsh review because I was highly critical of the notion that the legal complex, as they conceived it, was in fact ideologically wedded to notions of political liberalism. And I argued that that's not the case at all. The legal complex is largely indifferent to political liberalism and is interested in law only insofar as it serves the needs of its clients. Those who are wedded to political liberalism are a tiny subset. The ACLU would be the paradigm example, but also the cause lawyers in their many forms. And so in that sense, I would have allied myself with Austin Surratt and Sheingold, Stuart Sheingold, as opposed to Terry, Lucien, and later Malcolm Feeley. I think I actually persuaded Terry that I was right. And I think he recognizes that within the legal complex, there are only a few lawyers who are truly devote their lives to trying to preserve the rule of law.
I think so. In the last paper that they wrote on this issue, or at least the last one I read, they do recognize that lawyers can help undermine, not just promote, political liberalism.
Which brings me to the last point, and in some ways the most important and the most difficult, which is, why did the bad lawyers do the bad things that they did? And they were bad lawyers. John Yoo is the best example, and he has been denounced and criticized for the memos he wrote at the OLC. And indeed, they were so bad that they were ultimately withdrawn. And they were withdrawn in part because of a change in political attitude, but largely because they were very badly done. They simply did not make a coherent case for authorizing torture. And they badly misused precedent and legislation. The problem here is the hired gun, and the hired gun lies at the heart of Anglo-American legal systems and legal professions, and we simply don't have a good answer to it. I began when I taught legal profession, which I did for the 35 years I was at UCLA. When I taught legal profession, the first class was about that. And I said to students, I want you to come to class prepared to identify an instance of lawyering, which if you were asked to do it, you would refuse to do on moral grounds, and then defend your position. Why would you refuse to do it? And why is it legitimate for you to refuse to do it? And that's a very difficult case. I think we are all agreed, and I would agree with this, that criminal accused are entitled to the most vigorous defense that they can obtain, and that the lawyer who takes that position is doing the ethically mandated role. But there are all sorts of other things that lawyers do. So when John Yoo writes a memo which says, with the imprimatur of the Office of Legal Counsel, which says that it's okay to torture, I don't think the hired gun theory justifies that. And I think he should be criticized. I'll just give you one aside and then we can move on to your next question. But that summer, the summer of 2004, when the memos came out, because in the wake of Abu Ghraib, the memos were disclosed, I got a phone call from the head of the Alliance for Justice. The Alliance for Justice is an NGO in Washington that is primarily invested in trying to evaluate nominations for the federal judiciary, but it also seeks to ensure the integrity of the legal system in large part. The phone call was from the director, Nan Aaron, and she said, has John Yoo committed a disciplinary offense? Can we file a grievance against him, and what will happen to it? And I had to tell her, I thought not. I had been writing books, two books, one about disciplined lawyers in New York and one about disciplined lawyers in California. And we know what they get disciplined for. Mostly they do get disciplined for stealing from client accounts. They never get disciplined for representing the wrong person or taking on the wrong cause. It's almost unthinkable. This is where we are now about Rudy Giuliani and Jenna, whatever her last name is, the lawyers who have been filing the and Lynn Wood, the lawyers who've been filing the election cases, can they be disciplined for lying, both on the stand and off the stand, in legal papers and in social media, and for bringing frivolous actions? We don't know what the answer is. We'll find out over the next few years.
Your work proposes to understand what was most and least effective in attempts to protect the rule of law in the United States war on terror. We talked so far a lot about tools that failed. Even when you recognized here the importance of images, what you write in your book is that images were effective only under very particular circumstances. Otherwise, they failed as well. I don't want to add more hopelessness to the lives of our audience, and I also know that you have good answers to this. So I'm just going to ask, what caused the rule of law to survive in this war on terror to the extent that it did?
So in my earlier writings about lawyers, I was highly critical of the ideology of professionalism, which I saw as a smokescreen by which lawyers sought to legitimate actions that they refused to actually investigate and interrogate properly. But there is something to professionalism, and I want to say some good words about professionalism now, because there were many lawyers who rose to the occasion. When the first detainees were interned in Guantanamo in January and February 2002, the Center for Constitutional Rights began to consider whether or not it wanted to represent them. And I don't know the details of that, but I do know at least a little about it from talking to lawyers who work there. And that initial inquiry was, they were uncertain whether they should do so. Here were people who were accused of having masterminded the killing of 3,000 American lives in a horrendous attack in New York and Washington. Of course, they deserved representation, but did CCR really want to put itself out there? And after some debate, it did so, but it was the only organization that did so. So that was early 2002. Until the summer of 2004, they found it very difficult to enlist any lawyers in their cause. And then, with the production of the OLC memoranda, with the photographs of Abu Ghraib and with the expose of Abu Ghraib through the Taguba report, CCR put out a call for people. And then, of course, the three Supreme Court decisions, including the one that said, indeed, even though they were interned in Guantanamo, they had a right to petition for habeas corpus. The CCR put out a call, and almost 1,000 American lawyers signed up. And what they signed up for was years and years of effort, unpaid, of course, effort, on behalf of the nearly 800 people who were interned in Guantanamo at various times, filing habeas petitions and then appealing them up the appellate hierarchy. So, and they came from a wide cross-section. Some were large firm lawyers, some were solo practitioners, some were public defenders. They covered a wide range, and they weren't all equally competent. They weren't all equally well trained. They didn't all have the staying power. But it was an impressive outpouring of sentiment by the American profession. The ABA took strong positions. The New York City Bar Association took strong positions. And then there is more to be said about who else upheld the rule of law. I say in my books, and I'll make the statement first about the Bush and Obama administrations, and then bring it up today. I say in my books that I did a fairly crude, but I think a fairly crude statistical analysis of how judges decided a wide range of cases in the war on terror. I say it's crude because the index I used of the judge's political affiliation was the party of the president who appointed the judge. That's not 100% correlation. It's probably a 98% correlation. And I don't think that I had to code the outcomes as being for the state or challenges to the state. Once again, there could be some quibbles, but I think in most cases, people would agree with my coding. And in many areas, the correlation was exceedingly strong, 0.01, 0.001, in some cases, of correlation between political party and outcome. So it is unfortunately a fact that judges appointed by Democratic administrations were much more protective of the rule of law than judges appointed by Republican administrations. Other people have been doing that with respect to the last 4 years of the Trump administration, and I'm in the very early stages of doing that. I think we may find something different. I think on the one hand, that the Trump judges, and I think it's fair to call them Trump judges because they were crammed through by Mitch McConnell, and he appointed more judges than any recent president. The Trump judges are going to be even more slavishly supportive of Trump than other Republican judges. At the same time, I think we're going to find more Republican judges, not Trump appointees, splitting with Trump. Because Trump's actions were so outrageous. So political party is absolutely essential, and I'll come back to that later. I want, however, to talk about two or three other things. First of all, I made the observation, and I've gotten some pushback on this, but I made the observation that criminal prosecutions for alleged terrorism offenses proceeded in fairly routine form and resembled other criminal prosecutions. That is, the rule of law, if the rule of law is ordinary criminal prosecution, then under the war on terror, they followed that same process. I can qualify that, but I basically stand behind that position. And I believe that's because this is a highly institutionalized form of lawmaking. People are used to it. They have roles that they play, and they continue to play those roles even under outside pressures. There is some evidence that there are prosecutors in the Department of Justice, that is AUSAs, who have done the same thing, have pushed back against the Trump administration and have refused to bend the law under pressure from Attorney General Barr, most of all.
Which is another example of how professional socialization can moderate the penetration of law by illiberal politics.
But I want to also point to two other categories of actors who are absolutely critical. The media. I couldn't have written these books without the New York Times, the Washington Post, and many other newspapers. And their daily reporting and their investigative reporting, especially by the newcomers to the field, of Politico and the many other sources, are absolutely essential. And they continue to be the most important source of information about the Trump administration. And then finally, all the NGOs that we have out there who fight tirelessly to support the rule of law. So there are many sources of hope in civil society, and indeed within the government. What Trump kept on castigating as the deep state is what I like to consider the civil service, and those are the people upon whom we depend to keep the government running.
Before I let you go, I wanted to ask you to, as I like to say, open up your library and tell us what are the key readings that you would recommend to our project and audience.
As you know, in the shorter version of the talks I've been giving about my books, I come to the bottom line, which is that the paradox of the rule of law, whose purpose is to protect government from political influence, the paradox is that the rule of law rests on a political foundation. So you cannot protect the rule of law without engaging in politics. The best example of that is exactly where we are today, which is the Republican attempt to basically subvert the democratic process by disenfranchising large sectors of the electorate. If we cannot ensure fair and free elections, democracy is lost. And that battle is absolutely the core battle. But at the end of the day, the real question is how people are going to vote. And for me, the most frightening, appalling, and incomprehensible fact is that although Joe Biden got 81 million votes, Trump got 74 million. That's one hell of a lot of people. How did that happen? And that brings me to my library. So the suggestions I'm going to make, I think, will be surprising, certainly to your listeners and maybe to you as well. The problem is false consciousness. And the problem with the concept of false consciousness is, how can you talk about consciousness being false unless you know what true consciousness is, which is a reification? There is no foundation for true consciousness, and therefore, how can you call consciousness false? But the question, and this is something that people have been talking about for decades, is the vast majority of voters, the best proportion of voters who vote against their interest. So they vote for a Republican Party that is going to make them poorer and more miserable than they were before. Why do they do that? Well, one of the formative books that I read when it first came out in the early years of Law and Society was by Joseph Gusfield. And it was about symbolic politics, and it was about why America embraced prohibition, despite the fact that the vast majority of Americans wanted to be able to drink. And one could say the same thing about the war on drugs and many other similar campaigns. Joseph Gusfield was a student of and drew heavily on Murray Edelman, a political scientist at University of Wisconsin, and by the way, the father of Laurie Edelman, the former president of the Law and Society Association. So there's a lot of continuity there. And I think both of them draw on Max Weber's notion of status competition and symbolic politics. So people vote as an expressive act in order to align themselves with those people who they think will enhance their status in society, where status is correlated with a set of beliefs, or a set of actions. So it could be popular culture, it could be dress, it could, of course, be sexual behavior, such as gays and lesbians or transgender people. It could be levels of education. Those divides are getting deeper and deeper in American society. So on the one hand, you have huge economic divides, and those divides correlate strongly with educational divides and increasingly with geographic divides. We need to understand where those came from, and we need to understand where they are going. So I think we have to go back to the most fundamental questions, which was the question that you began with. In a deeply divided society, what are the divisions, what produce those divisions, and how can they be bridged? Those are the questions, and that connects to the rule of law, and it connects to political liberalism and to authoritarianism. But I think we have to connect it back to the most fundamental questions of how people conceive of themselves and other their opponents in ways that are cultural and then ultimately are reflected in electoral politics.
That was Rick Abel. Thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure.
If you like our series, please share it with your friends on social media. They can access our episodes on the main podcast platforms or on our website. And if you have comments or suggestions regarding the series or our project, feel free to contact me at fabio.isaiasilva@ou.edu.